Again, we are looking at the characters and symbols, and we are going to talk about a few that we are perhaps somewhat familiar with, or at least are fairly easy to define as we go to the end of this particular book. I want you to this particular chapter. I want you to just read with me, beginning in verse 17 and going down through verse 21, just to remind you of the context of these particular things we're looking at. We're told that the seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple of heaven from the throne, saying, "It is done." And there were noises, thunderings, and lightning. So there was a great earthquake, so mighty and so great an earthquake such as has not been since men were on the earth. And the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. And great Babylon was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. Every island fled away, the mountains were not found, and great hail out of heaven fell on men. Every stone about the weight of a talent. And men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, since the plague was exceedingly great. So again, with regard to this, the pouring out of the bowls of wrath, we are finally, as we mentioned before, seeing the judgment of God upon this evil and oppressive power that was troubling the people of God. And this final bowl, the significance, I suppose, that we would place upon that is summed up in the last phrase in verse 17, where the great voice from heaven says, "It is done." This is the accomplishment of God's judgment upon this evil power, dragon, the beast, the false prophet, the harlot that we will have introduced in our 17th chapter in just a few moments, and also the followers of those great powers. The judgment is coming upon them. So it is done. You'll notice that in verse 17, as we look at again the characters and symbols that are up on the slide, there is that description given the temple of heaven. And that's one of the ones we're familiar with. We've talked about that quite a bit in previous chapters. It is just one of many descriptions of heaven that are given. We'll note the significance of the tabernacle as well as the temple in Jerusalem and the holiest place in both of those as being the dwelling place of God. We have seen already in Revelation chapter 4 and 5 the throne room of God, which is described here on this occasion as the temple of heaven. So it represented God's dwelling among the people in the tabernacle in the temple. We're talking about where God actually resides in reality, the place, the throne room of God that is located in heaven. So the temple of heaven is that description that is given. And I just wanted to note the voice, the great voice, which spoke on that occasion. The loud voice came out of the temple of heaven from the throne saying, "It is done." Now, could you identify for me who is the speaker in that? From the throne. In the description that is given in Revelation 4 and 5, those descriptions you have the Father, God, on the throne, Christ at his right hand. So yeah, it is the divine deity that spoke on this occasion. Whether from the throne it would indicate the Father or the Son, I don't know that we can know. Some might would say that it may have been angels or perhaps the elders that are before the throne, but most probably the reference here is to God himself, who says it is done, or the accomplishment of that. The second one, anybody want to, I'll just tell you, raise your hand if there's anything else you want to say before we go on to any particular symbol that we have up on the board. The second one that is noticed is that there was a great earthquake. The noises, thunders, and lightnings, then a great earthquake that is so mighty and so great an earthquake such as had not been since men were on the earth. So this is a significant earthquake. Again, we're not asking you to try to go back at any point in time in history, the first, second, third, fourth centuries on to today. to try to find an earthquake that fits this particular description, because you're not going to be able to do that. And we're not trying to do that as we discuss the book of Revelation, unlike the speculatists that try to in some way look at, for example, what's happening in our society today and trying to correlate that to some of the events that are found here in the book of Revelation. But I do want to note that earthquakes have been associated with the judgment of God from the Old Testament, and the imagery of an earthquake as being an indication of God's might and God's power, or being described in that way, are very common in the Old Testament. I'm going to give you just one example. And so this earthquake being the symbol of that judgment, the completion of God's judgment, we can go to Psalm 60 as an example to find some of the same type of language. Psalm 60 and verses 1 and 2 concerning the judgment of Israel. And Psalm 60 verse 1, O God, you have cast us off. You have broken us down. You have been displeased. O restore us again. You have made the earth tremble. You have broken it. Heal its breaches, for it is shaking. So that kind of language, again, is not something that is uncommon when discussing the power of God with regard to judgment. A good way to describe that power is the power that God has over the physical universe. When we take as an example in 2 Peter the 3rd chapter with regard to that final day of judgment, when we consider that the one who created all things will end all things in fire, the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up, the elements will melt with fervent heat, it is not surprising that that same God has the ability to bring judgment upon the souls of men. He is the all-powerful and omnipotent one. And so this greatest of earthquakes is a compelling way of describing that awesome and arresting power of God as judgment comes. And we'll note here, specifically, judgment comes upon the great city of Babylon, which is broken up into those three parts, as stated in verse 19 of the text. Questions about the earthquake? All right, third one then, and we'll go over these fairly quickly. I would like to get into chapter 17 and spend some time in it today. The great city. Now, this is going to be something that is significant, because if you will notice, we are told that there is a harlot that comes up in chapter 17. Won't read it now. But the harlot, you'll notice in verse 5 of chapter 17, is described as Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. You will notice as well in verse 18 of chapter 5 that the woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. So what we're describing in this Babylon introduced here in the Great Bowls of Wrath, and as we see her identified in the 17th chapter, we are talking again about a great city that is described as evil, as wicked, described as a harlot in the very next chapter. So when we talk about this great city, we are talking about that center of power of this evil oppression. We'll talk about this a little bit as we get into chapter 17. But I would remind you that much of this is, again, dependent upon the date that you view the book was written. Or when the book was written, either AD 69 or thereabouts, before AD 70, with the destruction of Jerusalem, and the references, most of them have to do with the judgment of God upon the city of Jerusalem and upon the Jews on that occasion. Or if you take a later date of writing, AD 96, which is the construct that we've been using in our study primarily, then it has reference to the Roman Empire. And so let's just say it's the Roman Empire, then what is the center of that Roman Empire, the city of great influence? That would be the city of Rome. And so whatever we're talking about in this case, you have in the description the sea beast, you'll remember, which was the political empire of Rome. And then the woman who is described in chapter 17 in verse 1 is sitting upon that beast, is the great city, which is what the empire upholds, and that would be the city of Rome. That would be the explanation that I would give to it. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we get into the 17th chapter. So there are two views that are generally accepted or viewed by Christians, and that is it is either Jerusalem or it is Rome. There are some who say it's the Catholic Church. There are others who would use other cities to describe it. Constantinople is one that has come to mind, and there may be others that are mentioned in various theories, but we're going to take that concept of Rome. The division of this city that is stated there in the 19th verse, where it is said that it was divided into three parts, is indicative of her destruction, which is described later in the 18th chapter. We'll talk about that a little bit later in more detail. So this is an indication, again, of the judgment of God being visited, the defeat of these evil powers that are identified, again, as the sea beast, as the false prophet, as the dragon, as the great harlot, in this great battle, this judgment of God that is coming upon them. This defeat would be seen here in the destruction of this great city of Babylon. The only thing that I would add to that is you'll notice that as it stated there in verse 20, that every island fled away and the mountains were not found. Every island fled. And again, when people try to take literal things, then they're bound by literal translation or a literal explanation of all of these things. So if they're going to take a particular view of some literal earthquake, then we need to find literal islands fleeing and literal mountains hiding to where they cannot be found in this regard. This is simply an indication of the fact that in the face of God's wrath, there is nowhere to hide. No remote place that you can go to escape that wrath, that the wrath of God is being visited upon you as the unrighteous. Okay? So that's what we're going to actually enlarge upon as we get into the 17th chapter, the introduction of that judgment upon this great city, as mentioned here in the 16th chapter in verses 17 through 21. Questions, comments about Babylon, the great city? Okay, then the next thing I want you just to note, the cup of his wrath. And there's not much reason for us to go into detail about it. We've already mentioned a number of symbols indicating the wrath of God. We've talked about the wine press. We've talked about the bowls of wrath here in this particular chapter. And now we're talking about a cup of wrath. And they're all indications of repositories of God's wrath that are being poured out. What had been held back, what had been contained at this point in time is no longer being contained. It's being, in effect, spilled out. Remind you of Revelation 14, verse 19. When the angel thrust his sickle into the earth, gathered the vine of the earth, threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God, and the winepress was trampled outside the city. Blood came out of the winepress up to the horses' bridles for 1,600 furlongs. And so this is just a symbol of God's judgment, God's wrath being poured out upon men. And then the last one is an interesting one, the plague of hail. And again, this is something that will be familiar to Jews and Jewish Christians and those Christians who had an understanding and knowledge of God's will, God's old covenant with the Jews, because the plague of hail was something that was visited upon Egypt as a part of God's judgment upon Egypt and the efforts that God had to bring Pharaoh to let the people go out of the land of Egypt and into the land of Canaan. So as a part of God's judgment against this city, we are told in verse 21 that great hail out of heaven fell on men, every stone about the weight of a talent. Anybody know what the weight of a talent equals in today's figures? Mom? Okay, that's a good estimate, probably. Where'd you come up with that?
It's in my big Bible.
Okay, good deal. So, the source that I referenced said 100 pounds. We're talking about big stones, so 75 to 100 pounds, great stone, hailstones coming down. Now, I've told this story perhaps before in some illustration. I've been here for over 30 years, so I've told all my stories at least once or twice, maybe 10 or 12 times. But when the big hailstorm fell in the city of Fort Worth, it was at that time the most destructive storm in United States history with regard to property damage. Debbie and I happened to be downtown in Fort Worth with another couple going to watch a movie. And I dropped them off and was looking for a place to park when the hailstorm hit. And I managed, we did get a few big dents on our van, but I managed to find a bank drive-thru to hide under until the storm passed. So I got out. I was safe because the roof was over my head, and simply watched vehicles on the street being destroyed by this hailstorm because the hailstones were about softball in size. And it's an interesting thing to see hailstones falling from heaven that big and bouncing off of cars 10 or 15 foot up in the air. And when I finally parked in the parking lot where the movie was, every single car there was demolished. Broken windshields, big, terrible dents, and I pulled up in my van with just a few dents on my van. I felt pretty good about it. That convertible that I parked next to was completely destroyed. And that's with stones of this big. Can you imagine stones that are 75 or 100 pounds in size falling upon men? The indication is what? Not that there are literal stones, literal hail, literally 75 to 100 pounds, but this is, again, an indication of the fierceness and the totality of God's judgment visited upon those who are oppressive. And this is a very, very visceral and visual description that is given here to indicate just how great his wrath is and how inevitable it is that you will suffer if you stand in the way of God. Ultimately, those who are the powers of evil, as well as those who worship the mark of the beast, who have the mark of the beast, these individuals who are following after this false religion and this oppressive power, they will suffer the consequences of God's wrath. So that's one that, when I looked at it, I thought, well, you know, I can see that in my mind because I saw something much lesser than that, but I saw it in person, so I know, and perhaps most of you have, because hail is very common in this part of the world. Okay, questions, comments about the remainder of the images that we find in the 16th chapter as we draw this to a close. All right. Then what we want to do now is to go into the 17th chapter. This is, in as how we've divided up the book, the 17th scene. It's been lately for the past 4 or 5 lessons that they correlate. They won't continue this way, but there is a scene for each chapter, which isn't surprising since the chapters were added afterwards. So these are natural divisions. But now, after we have talked about the pouring out of the seven bowl of wrath, we have an identification, a description that is given here at this place of this great harlot, this great city, this Babylon. And so we're discussing the judgment now. We're going to go into more detail about what is alluded to in the 16th chapter with the pouring out of the bowls of wrath, the description of the defeat of this, these evil powers, the beast and the prophet and the harlot, are described in chapter 17 and even more so in the 18th chapter. So chapter 17 and 18 will be combined together as we see the identification of these things as well as the end of their reign. And that's what we're going to be talking about in the next couple of chapters. Now, as we've talked about it, and I want to make a few comments before we actually read the text, we have already described that Babylon is described as this great harlot in this text. So we're going to identify who the great harlot is. We want to note that the fifth verse, where it says, "On her forehead a name was written, Mystery Babylon the Great," doesn't settle that question. And unless someone takes the view that the destroyed city of Babylon would be rebuilt at some point in the near future at the time of this writing, and as a result of that would be judged, but that makes really no sense at all. Babylon on the Euphrates, which was the city, the capital of the Babylonian Empire. So there are other cities that are under consideration. We've talked about Jerusalem as an example. There are others that are noted. A description that is given, an interesting thing, you'll notice in verse 9, "The mind which has wisdom, the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits." The woman, the city, sits on seven mountains. Now, what does that mean? Well, actually, that really doesn't help a lot with regard to the description either. It's interesting that the city of Rome is built upon seven hills, seven mountains. We can go out and describe what those mountains are. But someone would hasten to say, well, Jerusalem is as well. And while there may be a little bit of discussion as to whether that's a legitimate thing, you can go to geography and you can specifically state there are seven hills or hill-like structures there in the city of Jerusalem. But it's not just Jerusalem, but Constantinople. That apparently it's a fairly common geographical construct that that cities have hills on or surrounding them in those areas. So we need to go into a little bit more detail considering how to identify who the great harlot is or what city it is. I have my view that it's Rome, and I'm going to try to defend that view as we get into a discussion of the text itself. But I just wanted to note a couple of things concerning this aspect of her being called a great harlot before we actually get into the reading. I want you to note that that kind of language is used about a number of cities in the Old Testament. And I want to give you some examples of how that usage can be seen. Notice, for example, with regard to Jerusalem in Isaiah chapter 1. Isaiah 1 and verse 21, and with just one verse, you can turn there if you would like, or at least make a note of it. But I'm going to read it now. Isaiah 1, verse 21, and this is referring to Jerusalem, how the faithful city has become a harlot. It was full of justice, righteousness lodged in it, but now murderers. And again, this concept of harlotry would be indicative of idolatry. It would be indicative of immorality. It would be indicative of unfaithfulness to God. And so there were certain times, and certainly in the first century, where Jerusalem could be described in that way. And Isaiah describes her that way in Isaiah 1 and verse 21. A very similar description is given by the prophet Nahum in chapter 3 and verse 4 of his book of prophecy concerning Nineveh. Nineveh of Assyria, the one empire that predated the empires of Daniel chapter 2. Nahum chapter 3 and verse 4, and Nineveh of Assyria, because of the multitude of harlotries, of the seductive harlot, the mistress of sorceries, who sells nations through her harlotries and families through her sorceries. So there is a description of Nineveh in that way. An interesting one, because of how similar it describes what we're going to read in just a moment, is Isaiah's prophecy concerning Tyre. Tyre was a very immoral city. Tyre was an evil city that existed during the time of Isaiah. And in chapter 23 and verse 17, Isaiah chapter 23 and verse 17, concerning Tyre, we are told, "It shall be at the end of 70 years that the Lord will deal with Tyre. She will return to her hire and commit fornication with all the kingdoms of the world on the face of the earth." And you will see in just a moment, as we read the text of chapter 17, that the contrast of the city of Tyre with the great harlot is one that is very much paralleled, especially with regard to the immoralities with all the kingdoms of the world. Okay? So, let me see here. And then the fourth one that we want to note is Babylon. Not that it is specifically referred to as a harlot, but Babylon is described in Isaiah 47 as the Lady of Kingdoms due to the extent of her influence, and much like the harlot of this text is described in that way concerning how that she is, notice verse 18 again, "the woman whom you saw, the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth." So this is the thing to keep in mind as we begin the reading of the text in a moment, is the most important thing is to remember the representation indicates great influence and is described as a world domination, committing fornication with the kings of the earth, influencing all of the earth. But not only that, and more importantly, great evil. Whenever you find the description of a city or even the actions of a group of people as being harlotry, that is an indication of great wickedness. It can, of course, literally have reference to sexual immoralities. A woman who gives herself over to hire for sexual favors. But it also certainly has reference to idolatry. and indicates just how God views a people, a city, a nation, who go away from Him and begin to court other idols and to bring other idols to have a relationship with instead of being faithful to God Himself. And harlotry is used from time to time to describe that. So look at the passage, chapter 17, in verses 1 through 18. I know it's a little bit more lengthy reading than what we've been doing normally as we read a scene, but I think it's important always to do this. Now, again, in our particular practice for our visitors, we are going to read the text. I'm going to ask for any impressions that anyone might have, any thoughts initially. We're not really trying to delve into what the text means, but how does it impact you? Maybe an overall thought that you might have that will be helpful to us as we get into this chapter, and then we'll begin to go into more detail in the following slide. So let's start off with chapter 17 and verse 1 and read down through verse 18 of the text. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. And so he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold, precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and all the filthiness of her fornication. On her forehead, a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman, drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. And the angel said to me, Why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast that you saw was and is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. And there are seven kings. Five have fallen. One is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue for a short time. The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth, and is of the seven, and is going to perdition. And the ten horns which you saw are ten kings, who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings to the with the beast. And these have one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. And he said to me, The waters which you saw where the harlot sits, their peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. And the ten horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot, make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to fulfill his purpose, to have one purpose, and to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. This, at first reading, at least for me, has been the most difficult of the chapters with regard to understanding what the significance of these things are. In the study that I have, I've got views, I've got conclusions I have made. I don't want to be dogmatic about a lot of them. But we will share with you our understanding of things and perhaps have some discussion in that regard. But when you talk about a beast who was and is not and yet is, or when you talk about the various kings and what they are, the seven kings, the ten kings, all of these kinds of things. That beast too, which I understand who the beast is, but it says it was and is not and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to ruin or go to perdition. What is indicated by those kinds of things and what significance we will place on them? It's going to take a little bit of delving into the text and a discussion perhaps for us to derive some idea of what is being talked about on this particular occasion. Let's put it this way. Instead of questions, let's just say I've got some thoughts myself that I'll put up on the screen in just a moment, but are there some first impressions that you have received at the reading of the text? Yes, Aaron.
Well, it's funny that the angel says, "Here, let me explain it to you," and it's no clearer than it was at the beginning. I think that's amazing, and given what Revelation is trying to do. Of course, it's not written down for us. So it's complicated. That's the overarching thing, is it's complicated. There are a lot of moving parts, but yet at the end, the result is still the same.
That's great. That's a good point to make. And I don't say it often enough. I probably should begin every class by saying the theme of Revelation is victory in Jesus. That God wins, that God has won, that the victory is assured and accomplished, and it is a message of hope that is given to the individuals who first read this book and perhaps had a little bit more clear understanding of what was being said. And it's the same lesson that we learn as well. When you look in this particular text in verse 14, these will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. Why? Because he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. That's why we win. If we are with him, if we are among those who are called, then we don't have to worry about how this is all going to come out. It's something that is obvious. How it comes to an end, and that's something for us to rejoice in. So that would be what I would say as well. We've got views, we've got ideas as to what some of these things are, but it is complicated. But don't sweat the small stuff, because the overreaching theme of Revelation is that the victory is assured. And that would be for them in the first century, and the lesson is the same for us as well. Anybody else? Yes, Dan.
Martyrs in verse 6, that you struck with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs. And oftentimes we get the wrong idea of what martyrs stood for in Greek. Just because it's come to mean it meant witness.
Right.
And so these are witnesses of Jesus who were put to death, and now we see that. The idea of being put to death for what you believe.
Yeah.
And that has become the term. But it is the witnesses of Jesus that they're talking about here, and that brings them death. And we ought to understand that relationship.
I appreciate that. That's a very good point. And the interesting thing, and Peter refers to this as well, if it is a cause to rejoice if any man suffers as a Christian. So persecution comes. Sometimes people mistreat you. Sometimes you deserve it when you're mistreated because of what you've done, the evil that you've committed. But there is a group that suffer specifically because of who they are. And they suffer because of who they are because of what they do. And that is they witness. Talking about the apostles. So as we know, or at least as we believe, 11 of the 12, and then, of course, Paul dying in prison, but they were martyred, that is, they were killed, because of their witness. They were ambassadors of Christ. There were many individuals in the first century. Stephen would be another example that could rightly be called a martyr. In fact, the first martyr recorded in the New Testament, but it was his witness that he was the Son of God that led the Jews to stone him to death. And so dying for the cause of Christ, because you testify concerning the Christ, is the significance of that term. And I appreciate you pointing that out, because it's not merely dying for Christ. It is dying as a witness to Christ. And that, of course, is something that was happening here in the time in which book of Revelation was written as well. Anybody? Yes, Jack. Josh.
Here we are in another chapter. different from the last, different from the one before that. And even though all of it is perplexing and the parts that we can't understand and the parts that we don't understand sound like all of the other chapters, and I'm reminded of how today we can look at this and be like, oh yeah, well, that is clearly describing this here. And 50 years ago, somebody looking at this would be like, definitely describing this here. And going back every century to the end, to the beginning, that everything is different, yet everything is the same. And I am personally built up, identified by the fact that we can know that there's victory in the land. And it strikes me with the trials and tribulations that we go through today, even though for us in these times, in our situations here in the States, it's very simple, it's very easy, our trials and tribulations, yet nonetheless we have them. And while it's very different, it all is the same.
Appreciate that. Very good. We are about out of time. I'm not going to give my thoughts yet. We'll start there next week. But there is one thing I would like you to do. I want you to notice that the great harlot, we are told, is seen in the wilderness. And there is the description of the woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on the head a crown of 12 stars that went to the wilderness to escape the dragon. That's found in chapter 12. And I think that's kind of an interesting contrast that can be made. And so I would like you to read before next week, read the 12th chapter, just the first parts of that. Familiarize yourself, remind yourself of that great woman that is described. And we want to spend just a few moments contrasting her to this location where the Spirit, or that he went into the wilderness, the angel took him into the wilderness and revealed this other woman that is riding on a scarlet beast. And we're going to kind of compare and contrast those two women, because I think they are the antithesis of one another, and I think a good point for us to make. So we'll pick up with the material with this scene, looking at the thoughts that I have, because I have a few things I want to share with you. And we'll probably be getting into the characters and symbols before the end of our time together next week. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today.